Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 14th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk astronomy and welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. If you have a question about the heavens, this mysterious object that's going around the sun, which may spell our doom or possibly not, anything at all, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the question to voxpop@wamc.org. Should be a fun one today. Bob Berman, Dr. Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up on this astronomy edition of Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers on hand today to help you figure out all the stuff you see in the sky at night. Well, at least the things we know about. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob Berman, is astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, and he's hard at work on the new edition right now. He's a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She's getting ready for a new semester. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question for these two, give us a call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Valerie Rapson, are you ready for another school year?
Oh, I'm getting there. I mean, it's a little sad that the summer's over, but it's always exciting to see a new crop of students come in, and it sounds like I'm going to have your daughter in my class, too.
Well, she's in the other intro astronomy class, mm-hmm. but she wants to switch
we're,
in.
We're going to switch her over.
You know
it's
why?
All good.
The other one's about the Big Bang, and she mm-hmm. said to me, and I thought this was hilarious, she's, I'm not a real big proponent of the Big Bang. I said, wow, okay, all right, you're going to be
all
a
right.
freshman in college? That's okay. So we'll see what happens there. Bob Berman, you said you were going to be trying to finish up your, what, about a third of the entire Farmer's Almanac is astronomy, so you have a lot of work ahead of you.
Yeah, we're doing the 2027 print issue. It's one of the final magazines, I guess, that's still in print. Oldest magazine in American history, been around since the 1700s. But yeah, this is the month that we do that.
Cool. And what are you... Can't you have AI do the whole thing and just put your name on it now?
No, it's got to be, I do a simulation of every single night of 2027, morning and the evening. That's when the cool stuff, the planets generally tend to happen mm-hmm. at their best. And of course, we've got a clientele that are not astronomers, so we want to do the things that pop out that's easy astronomy.
So I brought up, as we were batting around ideas in the last few days, I brought up this Comet 31 Atlas, which is making some... There are some competing theories about what it actually is. And then Valerie said, you know, there's so much information that you really have to vet on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bob, you said the same exact thing. So let's talk about how to sort of do your own vetting of information. The internet is full of stuff and not all of it is true.
Yes. Yeah, it's one of the things that I teach in my intro astronomy class a little bit is like, how to identify what's a picture versus a cartoon. Because as a novice astronomer, most people mistake these beautiful cartoon images of the planets and nebula for real pictures, and they're totally not. So we talk about what to look for and things that, you know, just make it obvious that it's a cartoon and not a photo. But also just like checking the websites, you know, on social media and stuff, you see these really crazy videos that look amazing, but then you go to the NASA website and you see nothing about it. So you really have to check your sources and make sure that what you're seeing is like a real thing and not something AI generated or some sensational video that's been posted.
And you mentioned a video that I have not seen that has been making the rounds.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was this supposed video of somebody who was looking at the moon and this little asteroid came by and smacked into the moon and created this little like puff of smoke. And when I saw it, I was like, wow, that's amazing that somebody caught that. Like, that was my first instinct. And then I'm like,
Wait.
That is way too clear. You know, like, there's no way the asteroid, as small as it looked in the photo, would have, or the video, would have to be, like, humongous for us to see it. And the crater that would have made is way bigger than the little poof that we got of smoke.
Funny.
So, like, you know, I finally searched it up and, you know, realized it was just some AI video. But it was really cool and misleading, even for somebody who sees this stuff all the time.
You know, Bob, you, and I forget the name of the book, it's sort of not a full-on book, but it's a booklet of the most wonderful things in the universe. And I forget what that is. I have it at home, and it's got stunning pictures.
Thank you. Yeah, and that was the 50 strangest things in the universe.
That's it. And you made a point just now about, you know, even things as simple as colors of nebulae and things like that that you see, they're not really accurate.
No, it isn't. And I guess that's okay. I haven't even made up my mind about it because there's so many astrophotographers who are using the new equipment that tracks things very easily, and there's new photographic equipment that does so well. I don't even touch that stuff because there are people who do it so much better than I could ever do it. But mm-hmm. The images are computer enhanced, so you're getting images with deeply saturated blues and reds and purples, and that's not how the universe looks. They're gorgeous pictures. Now, I'm not saying that that's wrong or that's bad. It's just not really real. That's all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you see things, and when I was on summer vacation, we have these astronomical binoculars that Valerie recommended a few years ago and we bought. And I saw some globular clusters. And it, to me, it was the most exciting thing with these binoculars. And we vetted it, made sure with our app that it was the right thing. But it's just a smudge. It's not even that exciting, you know?
Right. It's like everybody, you know, comes to the telescope on campus and expects to see something like Hubble or James Webb is going to show them. And it's like, yeah, our eyes really can't perceive the color with such low light conditions that you just get a bright white and fuzz and like maybe a little bit of color now and then, but really not that much.
But if I was orbiting Jupiter and the radiation didn't kill me, would the red spot look red? Or dark brown?
It's subtle. It's subtle. And in fact, it seems to change over the decades. Even now, when I spoke to Carolyn Porco and others who are imagers and experts on the professional level and said, what makes the color? She said, we're not sure. Mm-hmm. It could be a potassium compound. It could be phosphine. It could be, they're not even sure. But it seems to vary from brick red to pinkish to, and I've observed it with big telescopes and I can't give you a final word on that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the Juno spacecraft that's orbiting Jupiter now has a camera on board that can take, like, realistic color photos. So there are some online, which they can also be enhanced, like Bob was saying, so you can't trust all the Juno pictures. But they do have a really nice one that shows the red spot rotating, and it is that, like, light pinkish color, and that's supposed to be, like, what it would truly look like if you were
so
there
cool.
Looking at it.
I mean, and having these astronomical binoculars and being at the beach up north where there wasn't much light,
mm-hmm.
you know, was it Spica, very blue? Is that very blue?
Yeah, very blue.
It looked so blue. It was insane.
Yeah.
And so that's legitimate color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the stars you can definitely see
the differences. You've got to come down to the Woodstock area sometime, Ray, and share a night with me with my Takahashi Observatory there. You would
Takahashi.
Love it. With your family. Bring your family.
All right, fair enough. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Let's grab an email or two, then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. All right, here's one to start. This is from Fred. I like this one. I've heard that we are convinced that the universe is infinitely large, as we see no indication of it differing to the event horizon. What bothers me is that if I were an ant in the middle of the Great Plains early in U.S. history, from the ant's perspective, everything would be plains all the way for the ant. Yet beyond that ant's event horizon, we humans know there are mountains, great lakes, swamps, oceans. How are we so sure that we are not like that ant and just cannot see an indication of the universe edge beyond our own vision? That's from Fred.
It's a good point. And Valerie said something the last time we were on that stuck with me, even though I can't remember the exact quote, but it was so true, which is that the more profound the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the last
yeah,
half of that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know that I remember exactly what I said, but something like, you know, the bigger the issue, like the harder it is to answer, but the more we want to answer that question or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. The deeper the issue, the more we're groping around.
Yeah.
It's really strange that we know the details of things like the diameter of lunar craters. We know that down to a few meters.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to issues like, is the universe infinite or finite? Is it did it start with the Big Bang or not? And
right.
if it did, what were the antecedent conditions that created the Big Bang? We shrug our shoulders.
Mm-hmm. And I think we are, you know, exactly that ant in a sense that we only have the capability to see our observable universe. Like we literally can't look past the limit that light gives us with our telescopes. So how do we truly know? I mean, we have theories and models that suggest that it is infinite in some situations, but to actually observe that and prove infinity, that's really, really hard.
And for people who didn't really understand, when Valerie said, all we can see is the observable universe, mm-hmm. that's a big thing, because most people don't realize that there's really two universes. The observable universe is the one that that the light reaches us or even has a chance of ever reaching us. But beyond it, there's a very definite boundary to that. And then beyond it is the universe where the light will never reach us. And obviously, we can't say anything about that universe, because mm-hmm. if we get no information, we're just speculating. Now, we assume that we can just extrapolate and that what we see nearby continues on to some degree. But we really don't know for sure.
Speaking of speculation, and before we take a break here, there's this comet. I alluded to it earlier. I believe it's Comet 31 Atlas,
it
right? Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
And Avi Loeb, who is an eminent astrophysicist from Harvard.
But he's wacky a little bit.
Okay. Well, no spoilers yet. So he says, well, there's a 40% chance this might be an alien spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
Valerie, to me, it's a comet, but what's the deal?
Yeah, well, it's 3I Atlas, I think, just so
oh,
we're
3I?
Clear. 3, because like I is interstellar, and it's the third one, so it's
okay.
not a 31.
So it's interstellar, meaning it came from outside of our solar
space.
System.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, well, so the paper that Avi Loeb is part of, much more than the online articles say, you know, really takes a cautionary tale and says this is more of a thought experiment. It's fun. We're going to speculate
okay.
some things. So, you know, the media doesn't say that because that's no fun.
That's
but if you actually read the paper, it like five times on the first page, it says we're speculating. This is cool. We should think about it. But it's not necessarily 100% serious.
So interesting.
We should start there. But it does bring up some really cool things, like the fact that this object came in the plane of our solar system instead of coming up from above. Above and below. It's looping around the backside of the sun, making its closest approach when we are on the opposite side, so we can't see it at its brightest point. And it also is coming in at just the right speed and angle to either speed up or slow down such that it could intercept Jupiter easily,
huh.
or even send, like, God forbid, missiles to Earth or something,
huh.
if it really was. So these are the things that they're speculating, but they are, you know, wild speculation. It's just interesting that a lot of weird things seem to line up with this particular object.
It's so, and Bob, I'll let you get the last word before the break, but it's so funny that we talk about sort of misinformation propagating in the wild on mm-hmm. the internet. And here it is. This guy clearly said in the beginning, this is a thought experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everywhere now.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Bob,
well,
30 seconds.
That's nice that he said that, but he's the one who previously speculated that there might be an alien object at the bottom of the ocean.
That's not proven yet.
No, but he has a history of this kind of wild stuff. The point is, it's once you go that route, he's saying that, yes, isn't it interesting that it's going to be on the opposite side of the sun so we can't see it just when we're at its when it's at its closest point in the sun, we won't be able to see it. But, look, you could have just, what if it was on our side? Then he could have said, well, it's come in just the angle that it's going to meet us on our side of the sun. That
mm-hmm.
can't be a coincidence.
True.
So no matter what happens, once you're in that ballgame, you're going to find a reason why that's suspicious and why that's an alien.
Two things. One, the little spherical items down at the bottom of the ocean from this object, it's still inconclusive. Two, he said it was a thought experiment. Three, for a hippie, you are really, really skeptical about a lot of stuff, and that's good. That's science. Let's take a break. 800-348-25.
Am I still a hippie? That was a long time ago.
Oh, you're a hippie, man. 800-348-2551. We're going to light the incense. We'll be back. Yeah, thank you very much. That's Suspicious Minds, Cyrus Chestnut here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Astronomy Today, Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And Bob, in the break, you were railing against some of the true information that has been exaggerated to great extent about events in the sky.
Really? Anyone who's been on the web in the last week or two knows what I'm talking about. There are major events happening, but they've been exaggerated, and the reasons are clear that NASA doesn't do this, and the National Weather Service doesn't do this. We're talking about individuals who obviously are looking for clicks or looking for followers, and you'll get it through being sensationalist. For example, there have been many web sites saying, don't miss, there's going to be a blood moon lunar eclipse, and there's going to be a solar eclipse coming up in the next week. This was a few days ago. In the next week, don't miss it. Well, it's true that those events are coming up, but both eclipses will be totally invisible from all of North America. So when they say don't miss it, that's not really legitimate because nobody can see, no American will be able to see these things. They'll only be visible from overseas. Secondly, there's a meteor shower. As we know, the Perseids, which are usually pretty darn good. But this year we have an almost full moon. And that's it's already a couple of days ago now that it reached its peak, washed them out so that instead of 60 to 100 an hour, you'll see realistically 5 or 10 an hour.
Yeah.
But that qualification wasn't listed. And the one that was most egregious, I think, was lineup of planets. Wake up early in the morning to see a lineup of planets.
Endless.
And then just as Valerie was describing, there was a graphic showing all the planets packed together close up in a straight line. Mm-hmm. Well, there is an event, but it's two planets. It's Jupiter and Venus, which if anyone still gets up at 4 or 5 a.m., looks out their east-facing window, these are the two brightest objects in the sky after the moon. And it is worthwhile. It's worth setting the alarm for Jupiter and Venus. But where's the rest of the lineup? There's one other visible planet. You'd have to look all the way 90 degrees away to the southern sky, and there's Saturn, which isn't super bright. Mars already set way before midnight. Uranus is supposedly up, but nobody's going to find that. It's very, very dim. So there is no lineup, and yet many websites said wake up early for a lineup. So it's that kind of thing. In other words, bottom line, don't trust the web. Trust
Bob.
Yeah, you could trust the Old Farmer's Almanac. We're careful about that. But trust NASA. Trust NASA's website.
Okay, but listen. Now, here's the flip side. Valerie, obviously the show will be over if we don't take some calls soon. But doesn't this have a silver lining? It makes people interested and look up at the sky.
You said that before. No, no, I have to say that's not true because we, and that includes professional astronomers, say that if you look up at the sky and you're disappointed or confused because you're not getting what you're hoping to get, that doesn't win friends for science.
That's true. But at least they looked up at the sky.
And didn't see what they were hoping to see.
That's true. But hopefully they'll come and listen to the radio, come to some talks. You know, hopefully they'll want to learn more. So I don't disagree with you, but I'm just hopeful that, you know, I wish we could all find a happy medium. We need to stop the clickbait. We need to educate people a little bit more because we do want to show them exactly what's in the sky and give them true expectations.
All right, listen, we got to go to the phones here, Bob, if you're off your soapbox. Daniel's in Troy. Daniel, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. Is all energy is motion energy? Years ago, Bob Berman wrote in Astronomy Magazine, he wrote that, if I'm mistaken, please correct and expand.
All right, Valerie.
So I think he was asking about if it was like motion energy, thermal energy, I think is what we're going for. So, I mean, all particles that are moving, you know, we all emit, like have thermal radiation. So we're emitting at different wavelengths of light. You know, humans emit in infrared, stars emit invisible and really all wavelengths. So I wouldn't say that all energy is necessarily motion, but most things that are moving or, you know, have internal particles that are moving will have some sort of thermal radiation to them. I think that's what the caller's getting at.
Daniel.
Bob, go ahead.
And there's a thought that there's really only two types of energy. There's either kinetic energy, which is the energy of motion, and there's potential energy. Potential energy is like if you drive up a hill and then park the car on the top, it actually has potential energy because if you release the brake, it'll go down for free using the Earth's gravitational field. But why are we saying kinetic energy, the energy of motion, is everything? Because what we used to call thermal energy or heat heat, most people don't know this, is really motion. It's when atoms or molecules jiggle or move. We have a word for that. We call it heat. But heat is just the movement of atoms or molecules. And everything, when you boil it down to what the different forms of energy, chemical energy, thermal energy, we used to have a lot of different names for it, are really different forms of kinetic energy,
yeah.
is one very widespread thought in physics.
Yeah, that's definitely a better way to explain it, and they can transfer back and forth between like kinetic and potential energy.
Does that work for you, Daniel?
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Glad we got it.
800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson. Let's go to Argyle. Hello, Merle.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Bob, you don't come in very good, but the question is, if we are only seeing 4% of the universe or less, how can we make any mathematical equations work with only 4% or less of data?
It's Thank actually you, worse. It's worse than that.
So it was 0%.
Yeah. You're the 4% is not wrong, because if you consider that most everything is dark energy and dark matter, and you eliminate those, you are left with 4% that is the baryonic matter, that is ordinary atoms that they're used to, that things are made of, and the energies that we can see. But it's worse than that, because what we can actually observe is so much. We observe such a tiny percentage of the universe. Plus, there's types of energies that some call zero point energy, or vacuum energy, that it's tremendous. It provides a tremendous amount, but it's so mysterious that we don't even count it with the energy of the universe. So the actual energy that's observable is probably way, way less than 4%. Your point's well taken.
Yeah, I mean it's tricky to do the math, right? And what we are using in our equations is really describing what we can see, and then we fall flat when we try and explain dark energy and dark matter mathematically, because we can't see it. We can see how it interacts with certain objects, but it's still hard to put an equation or a description to it, because it's hard to observe.
Merle, thanks a lot for the call. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. You know, while you were saying that, Valerie, I wondered, in general, with your beginners classes,
mm-hmm.
what's the thing that really blows their mind when you give them some astronomical fact that nobody in your class even thought of? What really makes their heads explode?
They have two favorite days: Black Hole Day,
yeah.
and Life in the Universe Day.
Ah.
And I think those are the two most exciting, because especially with black holes, because they've heard about them, they know that there's something about black holes. But when you actually try and explain what they are and show simulations and show pictures and like describe how you're fitting like millions of times the mass of the sun inside of something that's smaller than the solar system, like that kind of stuff really blows them out of the water.
Yeah.
So trying to like deeply truly understand what it means to say fall in a black hole, that's the most exciting thing I think to them.
What do you think, Bob?
In the tours and lecturing for lay audiences, yes, I think definitely those things, alien life and whether it exists in black holes, are very pop topics and have been for quite some time. But lately I can light a fire under people when they realize that light, which is the one sense that we use to explore the universe, we obviously can't smell or taste or touch or hear anything in space, so it's all light. That light is not bright and has no color. That real light is magnetic and electrical, but not inherently visual. And the only reason we see it visually is because our bodies do something with that energy, and it creates the images. So right now, all listeners, if you look around the room, what you're seeing is the inside of your own brain, and that stuns people. You're not seeing the external world. You're seeing it's an internal experience. Yeah. All light is an internal experience, because there's no brightness in the actual outside universe. We've known this for a century. There's no color or brightness.
Right.
It's something that we create internally. And that's, I think, not only little known, but astonishing.
And along those lines, I think one of the most interesting things is even being as close as we are across this table, I am looking at both of you in the past. I am not looking at the present. There is, in fact, even my own synapses are behind.
Right. It's a slight delay.
Yeah. So is there a present? Is there a present?
Right. There's a present for you, which is different than the present for me.
But,
right?
Of course, in the room, I think very few people are aware that light travels a foot of distance in a nanosecond. It's a very even thing. You travel actually about 11 and a half inches in a trillionth of a second. And that's an easy fact, because it means however many feet away from the object you're looking at, like right now I'm about 5 feet from Ray.
Yeah, I'm not seeing far enough, but that's fine.
I'm seeing him as I'm seeing him as he was 5 nanoseconds ago, trillionths of a second in the past. So you can easily calculate what Ray was saying, how delayed the image is of the thing you're looking at. It's delayed by as many trillionths of a second as your feet from the object you're looking at.
Number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Matt writes in, is it possible to see Earth's shadow in the early morning around sunrise under certain conditions? I have no idea what they would be. Could it be this solid horizontal band of a darkish blue-gray color that I once saw above the horizon?
Yes.
Was that the shadow? Is that right?
Yes,
what are the
yes.
conditions that cause it to occur? And that's from Matt.
Yes, yes. I'm so excited to hear that because, yes, Earth's shadow is visible every sunset and every sunrise as exactly as he described, as a horizontal grayish blue band that hugs the horizon. It's sometimes called the twilight wedge because it's wedge-shaped. And above it, there's pink sky where the sun is still shining. So that bluish, dark gray, very sharply delineated line below which is bluish gray and above which is pink. Sometimes they call the pink part the belt of Venus. I don't know why, but the gray part is called the twilight wedge. That's Earth's shadow, visible every clear sunrise and sunset.
It's got to be super low, though, right? I guess I've never paid attention.
Hugs the horizon.
Yeah, yeah. So if you don't have a super good view, you couldn't see it. But
exactly.
Now I'm going to go check.
Yeah, you need a clear horizon.
Never really thought about it.
Valerie, one of the things I saw, and by the way, the number is 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question, email is voxpop@wamc.org. One of the things up in Maine at the beach where it's so dark, you can really see the Milky Way. What am I looking at?
Yeah, you're just basically seeing the gas and dust that's inside the spiral arm that's in the summertime, you're looking towards the center of the Milky Way.
We're in the Milky Way, though.
Yeah, so you're seeing, like, I tell my students, it's like you're a chocolate chip inside of a pancake, right? And if you're looking through the pancake batter, that's what you're seeing in the sky. It's just, you know, the slight reflection of light off of the gas and dust from the stars that are embedded in the spiral arm. So it looks like a thin band because the Milky Way is a flat, spiral-armed galaxy. And summertime is the best time because you're looking towards the center. You're looking through the thickest, the brightest part of the Milky Way. So, yeah, it's the best time to view it.
Bob, our position in the Milky Way, this solar system, where are we?
We're about 30,000 light years from the center, and the galaxy is 100,000 light years across. So we're 30,000 light years from the center, and Valerie is exactly right. We're seeing through the flatness, the thick part of our galaxy. One of our daughters was just in Monhegan Island in Maine and took a picture of the Milky Way from Maine. Want me to send it to you?
Not really. I've seen it.
All right.
But it's okay. The number is 800.
I can't please him today.
800-348. That's okay. 800-348-2551 is the number. All right. Getting back to this whole business about sort of quasi-information and incorrect information that's out there. Valerie, J.D. writes in from Pattersonville. Please share what you know about Planet Nine.
Yeah, I think we've talked a little bit about this, and we don't know too much. What we're basically trying to do is figure out if there's an additional planet far beyond the orbit of Pluto in our solar system, and we think there might be one because there's a lot of objects in the Kuiper Belt out where Pluto is that have a similar orbit around the sun that all kind of coalesce close to the sun at the same time, or at least at the same position. So we've been using big telescopes that scan the whole sky and do all sky surveys to look for like a small faint dot that's moving against the background stars that might be this additional planet that's out there. And we haven't been able to find one yet. But we are constraining where to look. And we have, you know, it's a many square degree part of the sky, but we've ruled out about 70% or so of the sky where we know it isn't going to exist based on the orbits. But now we can point, you know, some of our latest telescopes in the right direction and hopefully see this planet.
This is beyond the Kuiper Belt? Or this is in the Kuiper Belt?
Well, depends on where you define the border of the Kuiper Belt, but it's probably beyond. We're looking at something that's like, you know, 80 to 100 astronomical units out or even farther, depending on how big the object turns out to be.
Well, Bob, I mean, there are a lot of things out there. Why would this be important at all? We'll never see this
thing. Well, it depends on your viewpoint, whether it is or not. Pluto is mainly important because when it was discovered in 1930, it was the inspiration for the cartoon dog of the same name. Walt Disney used the new discovery of Pluto to name his new character, Mickey Mouse's companion, Pluto. So that's maybe the main thing, although its moon, Charon, is as interesting as Pluto because the two. We don't have any other case in the solar system of a planet and its moon being so nearly the same size. They only have a 2-to-1 ratio. So, and it's the only case where the moon has one side facing the planet and the planet has one side facing the moon. They both revolve around each other while rotating in about 6 days.
Huh.
And we're going to do that too. So it's a harbinger of Earth and our moon.
Oh, interesting.
In the distant future, we too, you know, as everyone knows, the moon is frozen in its rotation so that one side faces Earth. But Earth is slowing down so that eventually one side is going to be facing the moon, which means that half of Earth will have the moon in the sky and half Earth will never see the moon.
All right, we have to take a break here. But speaking of the moon, are you both on board with putting some nuclear power plants on there? There's some talk about that.
I'm always hesitant to do that kind of stuff.
Bob?
I don't trust
I like
That's
nuclear
humanity.
Power in general. I'm pro nuke in that way, but with all the solar energy available there, the real problem is that because That's of the true. Long lunar night of 2 weeks, will you have enough electricity to supply, let's say, colonists on the moon if you don't have an alternate source of power?
Yeah.
And that's where batteries that are up to the task could obviate the need for any nukes.
Well, batteries don't like to be cold, at least the current technology.
Good point.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here, and Valerie Rapson as well, and presumably you. 800-348-2551. Vox Pop at WAMC.org. Homestretch coming up. John Schofield, heck of a job here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today. Vox Pop at WAMC.org is the email address. Vox Pop at WAMC.org. By the way, I've got this live event coming. I just thought I'd mention it. August 26th. It's at Hart-Clewitt Museum in Troy. And Kathy Sheehan, who runs the Hart-Clewitt and is a Rensselaer County historian, will be there. We'll see some cool stuff from the museum. And the folks from Stair Galleries will be there. And if you bring your antique item or items, they'll give you verbal appraisal of it. It's going to be sort of a, we'll turn it into a radio show. We'll see how it plays out. But it'll be a fun thing. You can find out more, WAMC.org. Click on the link for WAMC On the Road. This email from Steve in Red Hook, limit to human understanding? When I taught an astronomy course in a local high school, we finished the course with a discussion of cosmology. I especially enjoyed challenging the students with questions such as, why is there something instead of nothing? If the universe had a beginning, what existed before that? We also discussed that there may be questions that humans may never have the intellectual ability to answer. Much like ants, most likely will never have the ability to perform integral calculus. I'd be interested in the panelists' thoughts. Is there a natural limit to what humans will ever be able to comprehend about the universe? This is from Steve in Red Rock. Hmm. What do you think? Val?
I mean, I like to think optimistically and say, you know, there is no limit to what we can learn, but we're only limited by our imagination, as corny as that sounds, right? You know, we have to keep developing new technology, new ways of observing things. We do have physical limits based on, you know, the fact that we are interpreting light and, you know, basic things that our bodies can do. But we've gotten so good at developing technology that can see in wavelengths that we can't see or perceive things that a human being would never be able to do. So I think that that puts us above ants in a sense that we can go beyond what our physical body could ever desire to learn or be able to learn. But yeah, Bob, what do you think?
We're so used to using our intellects, our logic, that some of us forget or never know, perhaps, that there are other ways of acquiring knowledge. Now, the intellectual logical system, as we all know, works dualistically or symbolically. The word water is not actual water, but this is what we use. We use math and we use symbols, and it works. If we want to build a bridge or do aeronautical engineering, it works splendidly and it works with science. But because we're in our heads all the time, too much, speaking for myself, we might forget, or some of us maybe didn't experience, that there is a separate, direct way of experiencing reality. And in the East, they're very much into it. It's called cosmic consciousness or mystical consciousness, and it sounds woo-woo and not real. But it's very real to those who've experienced it. And to those who've experienced it, you actually become one with whatever you're looking at or hearing, and know it and know the realities of it in a much deeper, surer, clearer, and unambiguous way than the symbolic way that our minds and logic work. So when the caller is asking, are there things beyond humans, it depends upon whether you're just speaking about logic or whether you're allowed to go beyond to direct experience. And those listeners, I don't know if it's 1% or 50% of the listeners who have ever had a cosmic consciousness experience will know what I'm talking about.
All right, this email from Glenn at voxpop@wamc.org. Number here is 800-348-2551. Valerie Glenn writes, what are the longest long-period binary stars? And has science ruled out the possibility that our sun is binary? Why is Sirius moving closer to the sun? All those questions from Glenn.
Yeah. So the distance, like the maximum distance you can have between two stars for them to be a binary system, depends on their own physical size, because the gravity goes off as 1/r², meaning if you've got a larger set of stars, they can be farther apart, still gravitationally bound.
Yeah.
You can have that binarity. So we see stars that orbit in hundreds of years, thousands of year time frame. They can be relatively far apart and be able to still be bound to each other. As far as I know, and I'm sure Bob can chime in, we don't have any evidence that our sun is a binary. Our solar system and sun don't move in such a way.
Wouldn't we know it by now?
We'd be able to see like this additional motion that's not just motion around the galaxy. It would be caused by some other object. And our sun is not that big. So the star would have to be relatively close to actually be bound to us to see it. So there's some talk about a star that flew by, you know, ages ago, but it's not a bound object that we know of.
What evidence will we have of something like that? I mean, what circumstantial evidence could you point to and say, well, a star went by very close?
Well, the disruptions in the planetary orbits and disruptions or collections of things in like the Kuiper Belt, where we see material that's kind of pushed together because something flew by and nudged a large chunk of objects gravitationally.
Uh-huh. But
that's how
we
can speculate that.
Couldn't
it
that be one of these Planet Nine deals that are really huge?
Yeah. It very well could be. Both of those are equal scenarios, and you just have to run your models to be able to see which one makes the most sense.
All right, Bob.
Well, back to the question about what's the longest period binary star, and is it some that are just off the charts?
Yeah.
We're used to the interesting one. The interesting ones are shorter period because they sometimes eclipse each other and produces changing in light. For example, the most famous one, Algol or Beta Persei, one star actually passes in front of the other every 2 days, 20 hours, 48 minutes, and 56 seconds. It's like Old Faithful.
Yeah.
It's absolutely steady.
Tremendous.
And so, of course, it's fascinating. But there are other stars like the most beautiful colored binary in the sky, Alberio, which is Beta Cygni. It's been seen since the 17th century telescopically. Gorgeous. One is blue, one is gold. There's been no change in the angles from one to the other or in how close they are in these 400 years.
Huh.
And so we extrapolate from that that its period, even though they're separated, they're 410 light years away, but they're separated by 34 arc seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Valerie knows what that means, which corresponds to more than the solar system separation.
Right.
Now, in our solar system, the farthest object that we know, Neptune, Pluto has an orbit of 248 years. Mm-hmm. This thing must be tens of thousands of years at least.
Wow.
So you do have periods like
How
that.
How many arc minutes?
34.
Okay, is there going to be a test
seconds,
on this?
Arc seconds.
All right, okay. Let's go to David in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Yes, good show.
Thank you.
My question is, where on Earth would be the best place to live to survive global warming?
Where on Earth would be the best place to live to survive? Or when the Earth becomes a red giant, or the sun becomes a red giant? Where?
Probably somewhere high up and somewhere in the middle of a continent, because you want to get away from all of that additional water that's on the coastline.
Interesting. What do you think, David?
Newark,
says Bob.
Newark.
There you go.
There you go.
Well, I like planet Earth, and I like to live a good life on it. So I wonder where the best place would be.
Yeah,
thank you.
You betcha.
There's some cool maps online. I mean, cool is maybe not the best word for
no.
this, but you can project forward, you know, what happens in different global warming scenarios, and you can watch all the coastlines flood and see that, like, you know, we're going to lose Florida and we're going to lose New York City and all these places. So
yeah, if you're really talking about global warming, a few years ago, doing an article for Discover, I had to interview the climate scientists at Boulder, Colorado, and they had all these computers.
Yep.
And I saw something that was very heartening for me, who lives here in the Hudson Valley or in the mountains. If you're not living on the coast, if you're living like I do up 1,000 feet, many of us have some elevation, mm-hmm. we're not going to, not only are we not going to get hit with coastal changes and floods from sea level rise, but they had shown that the effects of climate change and global warming will be minimal. And they showed where on the Earth it'll be minimal because of change in jet stream and many other
factors.
So
Newark is the place.
No, but generally the whole east northeastern United States is among the safest and minimally affected. There's one or two other places in the world, but in the United States, where about our listening area is just about the best place you could be for global warming.
Well, it's hard to make that case when it's been 90 degrees for the last week or so. But all right, I'll take your word for it. Father Tony wrote in, and it's good to hear from him, regular correspondent. He says, I may not have heard it, but in case I heard it on WAMC, a recent story about an object hurtling through space at 40,000 miles per hour,
mm-hmm.
and the speaker said it was definitely not from our universe and or solar system. Could you comment? Well, we've talked about this.
Yeah, we talked about that.
But
yeah.
Why don't you recapitulate slightly?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. That's become an axiom in astronomy and in science in general. So when you see something that's odd and there's things you can't explain, for example, we had Umeomea previously, which I'm probably mispronouncing, another comet-like object that came in from beyond our solar system, and it sped up and slowed down, and did it have to be an alien? No, it turned out because it's outgassing, the gassing that came out could have slowed it down and sped it up. The point being, there may be many explanations for odd behavior. And if you go right to aliens and especially...
No, he didn't. Father Tony did not do that. Father Tony just wants to know what it is, what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, as best we can tell, there's been three objects that come in, and we generally call them comets because we do see some of the outgassing Bob had mentioned in most cases. So, and that makes sense, right? If these are objects that are traveling through the freezing cold interstellar space, any material they encounter is going to condense and freeze onto them. And when they get closer to our solar system, they're going to warm up and they're going to outgas. So they tend to be comet-like objects, you know, maybe with a rocky core if they're big enough, maybe not. We don't know. But yeah, usually less than a few miles wide and they come flying on in.
But Bob, getting to your point, of course, we would need all kinds of evidence that this is something special. The only thing we know is it has come from outside the solar system, right?
It's true. But remember that a lot of people are alien. Valerie was mentioning that before. It's a hot topic in the public and in her classes. And people are quick to want to believe that aliens exist and are involved. And even if it's a little sinister, has sinister undertones, it still has great appeal. So we're just cautioning people that in science, well, if your car doesn't start in the morning, and you turn the key and it doesn't start, your first thought shouldn't be that maybe a meteor hit the electronic circuits overnight, or maybe the CIA has sent a black ops team to your car to disable it. Your first thought should be, well, maybe the battery's dead. So you start off using Occam's razor. In other words, the simplest explanation is usually the correct one. So with these comets coming in or anything else, let's start with the simplest, most logical things, and then we could go to aliens as the 20th or 30th or 80th possibility, but not the first or second.
I wish a meteor would hit my car. Like, I just want one.
Yeah,
that I fell in my property. That would be amazing.
Again, in fairness to Father Tony, he's well versed in mystical things, but I don't think he said they were aliens. So let's go to Eddie in Housatonic Falls. Eddie, you're on.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
You bet.
I have a question about a telescope I bought for my grandson. It's a Nexstar 10SE computerized telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought it probably 3 years ago. We've never been able to figure it out. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if there's somewhere around here that I could get information on how to set it up and you know, so we could use it.
Well, you need the Bob Berman of 20 years ago who would charge your fee and come to your house, set it up, show you how to use it, and do that thing. And it made a little bit minor part of my income that way. But if you can find someone in your local astronomy club who have telescopes, contact your local astronomy club, and they'll have somebody who will be happy to show you. Because you really need some hands-on instruction. That'll be best for you.
Yeah. If you're local to here, check out the Albany Area Amateur Astronomers. They're great. They have star parties. You can just bring your telescope to a star party and say, help me set it up, and they'll do it.
Yeah, people tend to be very generous.
Yeah, that's a tricky one to set up on your own. You can also check for videos online, but the local astronomy groups will help.
Eddie, I got to tell you, I was given this old, big, huge white telescope some years ago, and I love astronomy, and I've always said, I got to see Saturn through a telescope just once in my life. I couldn't even find the moon with this thing. It was terrible. Yeah. So, computer might help, man. I mean, if you can figure out how to work that, I think it'd probably make a lot of things easier for you.
Well, yeah, it will follow whatever you want to put it on. It's just not very instructions aren't very
clear.
Yeah.
Easy for me to understand.
I got you, man. Yeah, that's a good idea, though. Find a club. Mm-hmm. If you got the gear, would be...
So I can look that up online?
Yes, you can.
To find the club?
Yep.
Okay. All right, very good. Eddie, good luck with that. Appreciate it. The binoculars have been a boon. And this year, most of all, we really got great use out of it. Seeing that blue... Now, is Spica a binary star? A star?
No, it's not binary.
No, I don't think so.
It's definitely not a binary.
There's another one that was huge that is a binary star, and it was kind of orange. It was definitely orange.
I'm trying to remember. I mean, Arcturus is orange, but I don't think that's really binary either.
That's not binary, but try to look at Albireo, the one I talked about. It forms the head of Cygnus the Swan, or the base of the Northern Cross. It's part of the Great Southern Triangle.
Oh, very interesting.
Yep.
Someday we got to talk about constellations and the evolution of constellations and the kind of universality between cultures and some of the shapes that are perceived.
So my intern this summer literally just made a show. He's calling it Cultures in the Cosmos.
Really?
About this. Yeah, he's putting together, he covers a bit of the Western sky, which is the constellations we know of, and then he does the Ojibwe Native Americans, little Chinese, and a little bit of Hawaiian constellations, and shows how they overlap and the differences and the things they imagined in the sky. So that'll be playing as our planetarium show this fall, so you can bring your family and learn.
That is very cool. I mean, why do you think they overlap?
Well, they always, well, not always, but usually use the brighter stars in the sky. And those are very common for everybody in the Northern Hemisphere. So they tend to overlap a little bit using those brightest stars.
But the interpretation of them.
Well, some of them overlap, but a lot of them are very different. What's interesting is that there's like always bears. Every constellation or every culture put a bear in the sky somewhere up there. But I think part of that's just, you know, everyday life. Back in the day, there were a lot of bears running around.
Yeah, and surprisingly in the same place. The Big Dipper, which doesn't at all look like a bear, has been a bear in many disparate cultures.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. All right, we're just about done here. Bob Berman, if people want to find out about your tours and all your doings and whatnot, how do they do it?
Oh, yeah, thank you. I would say Bob Berman Tours would certainly take them there. I only hesitate because it sounds like I have a company and make a personal profit from each person, and I don't. But I'll certainly be the leader and the speaker, okay, and people who want to see next year's eclipse in Spain, for example, stuff like that.
Okay. Valerie, if people want to find out more about the planetarium.
Yeah, just search for the planetarium online. We'll have shows starting in September again.
Splendid. Thank you both. Thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. Support comes from Gloversville Sewing Center. Gloversville, a quilt shop offering a selection of fabrics and accessories, including Bernina and Janome sewing machines. A proud underwriter of WAMC for over 30 years. We're worth the trip. GloversvilleSewingCenter.com. SPAC, presenting John Batiste's debut with the Philadelphia Orchestra on August 22nd in celebration of the release of his new album, SPAC.org. And WAMC On the Road. It's our new programming initiative already, bringing public radio in person throughout the WAMC listening area, face-to-face with listeners in their own communities. WAMC.org for more information. I'm going to do one. And do you really want to be face-to-face with me? I don't think so. But if you do, you go to WAMC.org and you can find out more. It'll be a lot of fun. All right, Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, thanks again. Zach Malloy back at the helm there. Nice job there, Daddy-O. Susie Chekai screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. Cheese. Just cheese. We'll see you then.